Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your ninth grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Spencer Seams.
Oh, hello there.
Would you tell everyone where they might have heard you?
Well, at some point in the near future, I have a podcast coming out. Well, I have two coming out. One has actually, we've recorded some episodes called Tune In Tonight with Gina Radcliffe. You might know her from her blog, Tune In Tonight, about old TV that from the 70s and 80s and so on that people don't really care about or it's forgotten. And I write for Rhymes with Nerdy, where I do a regular column on stuff from history that gets overlooked, like African history or women's history or just kind of weird, fascinating things that I think should be more famous. And I review old TV shows for Summer Night Fight, like Twilight Zone, like sci-fi and horror stuff.
Spencer, you asked specifically for the subject tonight, which is the short stories of Ambrose Bierce. You have an interesting connection to Bierce, right?
Uh-huh. We share the same birthday. Not the same year, but the same date.
Ambrose Bierce is today almost exclusively remembered for his short stories, although he was a kind of a fascinating character and a journalist back in the late 19th century. And if you know of him only through an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, he's worth looking up. He's worth learning more about.
Oh, there are a ton of short stories that aren't as famous or read as much that really should be looked into, because he wrote a lot.
His short story output came kind of late in his life. He had been a soldier in the Civil War. He had been wounded rather badly and had to go on furlough. And then after the war, he did some more work for the Army. But he ended up in San Francisco as a journalist. And he was a journalist for a very long time. And then somewhere around 1888-89, he started writing all these short stories, and he ran through a crazy number of stories in just a few years. And it's these stories for which he's most remembered today.
And these stories were published in newspapers mainly too.
That's a good point to bring up, because we don't really have the same kind of general interest reader journalism that we had back in at one time. Some of my favorite writers are people who wrote for newspapers. Mark Twain wrote The Innocents Abroad as a series of letters to his newspaper. Don Marquis wrote the poetry of Archie and Mehitabel in a newspaper. And I find that absolutely fascinating that newspapers ran poetry as well as fiction and all kinds of general interest pieces.
And we should add that Bierce himself wrote poetry too, as well as short stories.
And he's also well known for The Devil's Dictionary, which was a collection of sardonic fake definitions that ran originally, again, as a newspaper feature until it got collected into a book.
Like, do you know if at the time people thought they were real? Or, I've always wondered about that, if like people thought those were actually true or not, or if they knew it was a joke.
He got into a lot of trouble as a journalist. Apparently he wrote a poem about the assassination of like a state politician. Then after President McKinley was shot, people saw this poem as having incited the assassination, and William Randolph Hearst had to defend him.
Hmm. So you thought it was like a John Hinckley and Catcher in the Rye type of thing?
I don't want to say too much here because I only know what I read online on Wikipedia.
He named his oldest son Day, which I think is a silly name.
And he also disappeared. That's the other thing that's
Yeah.
great about him is he nobody really knows how he died.
Yeah, he went to Mexico in 1917 during the Mexican Revolution, and he kind of disappeared at some point, and no one knows what happened after that.
There's all kinds of stories that he was shot in a firing squad, or that he fought in the Revolutionary War and died in a battlefield, or that he went native with the Mexicans and wandered off. Who knows? But I think it's great that he has that last bit of his legacy because he's also remembered as a kind of a ancestor to modern horror writing and modern strange fiction. And it may be something that you'll pick up on if you read the stories that we read for this podcast or not, but he had this vision of nature as being supremely uncaring and of life as being something of a joke. And it's no wonder that he was a favorite author of H.P. Lovecraft's.
That makes a lot of sense. But he's much better at dialogue than Lovecraft was.
Well, my grandmother is much better at dialogue than H.P. Lovecraft was. We're doing two stories by Ambrose Bierce. His stories tend to be very short, and at least the ones that we've read here have so little plot from the standpoint of if you actually wanted to say what happens in these stories, you could probably encapsulate them in about two or three sentences, but that doesn't begin to do justice to the experience of reading them. I mentioned before Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. We will get to that in a minute, but we are also doing a story you suggested.
Yep, it's well, these two stories I read in high school, and I was the type of student in high school that if we had assigned reading, I automatically hated it. And these two stories and Macbeth were the only things in high school where I had that were assigned reading that I actually really enjoyed. And everything else that I read in high school and not college so much, but in high school has been covered already, so I really wanted something to talk about on here.
The first story, A Horseman in the Sky, was from 1889. So this is being written about 24 years after the end of the war. And I think it's important to make a note here about the fact that Bierce's Civil War stories were not written during the war. They were written much later, and they were written after Reconstruction, which did almost nothing to make the life of African Americans any better in the South, and in some cases, perhaps made them worse. And so, a lot of people were looking back on the war and asking themselves what had actually been achieved, if anything. And there's a kind of a deep cynicism that runs through Bierce's writings.
Well, he was a very anti-war, and you can tell, like, with his writing, with his Civil War stuff specifically, he's making a point to not glamorize the war. He's making a point to point out that war is terrible.
Do you want to talk a little bit about reading this in class? I mean, do you have any memories from reading Bierce in class? I mean, I have the memory of reading Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which was the only thing we read.
I mainly remember being just genuinely surprised that I liked something that I was forced to read in class. And like I was also was happy that they were very short. 'Cause I remember right before we got to this, it was The Great Gatsby, which I'm sure is good, but just because of my memory from high school, I just can't bring myself to ever touch that again. And so after going through that, we got to these two stories, and I'm feeling like a huge sigh of relief that one, they're much shorter, and two, they just appeal to me on a much deeper level.
The first story, The Horseman of the Sky, is a story about a young Virginian soldier named Carter Druse. Although he's a Virginian, he is fighting on the Union side, and it's telling that he actually comes from West Virginia because West Virginia
Whoa.
famously broke off from Virginia during the Civil War.
Is it supposed to be West Virginia or just like Western Virginia?
West Virginia succeeded, I think, in 63, 1863, and
Around that. And yeah, I have a lot of family from West Virginia, so I'm very familiar with that.
oh, sorry, I didn't mean to tell you anything you
Oh.
didn't know already know, but
Oh, that's all right.
we come in on Carter on sentry duty. He's basically
Well, he's sleeping on the job.
And we're told that if he were to be caught, he would be summarily executed. Not much comes from his sleeping on the job. He fortunately wakes up in time, or unfortunately, perhaps, so you might think for his sake, to survey the situation. And about, I would say, about half of this story is given over to describing the landscape.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like tedious to read. It feels very natural and poetic, and it's just it like for a story that's mostly that's basically all description. It doesn't, I don't know. It just works, even though it doesn't have much dialogue or much story.
Since your family's from Virginia, you can speak to the beautiful way that the countryside is described here, because Virginia is an incredibly mountainous, rolling
Oh, yeah.
place and full of forests, and it sets up such an incredible scene where, from behind some laurels, Carter is looking, basically down a winding path. It's winding around a mountain in front of him, and he can see sort of the yawning cliff on one side, and the path winds out of sight and then back into sight many hundreds of yards away, where he can see a little outcropping of rock, and then below that he can see the whole valley below, and he can see a glade. And the narrative voice tells us that he's here because the Union soldiers are about to try to make an advance to the next valley over, where they know that the Confederates are waiting. And if they're spotted at any time during this advance, they're basically screwed because there's absolutely nowhere to run. You're kind of stuck on this path.
It's important to note that where they are is close to his home.
One of the wonderful things about Bierce is the way that within a very, very short story, we have a full-on flashback right at the point where Carter sees a horseman.
Yeah, a horseman on the land, well, or a rock in this case.
Again, beautifully described as standing so still that he thinks at first he could be a monument. Put up at some time later after the war to what's the and that kind of winking movement out of time is sort of the way that Bierce announces what he's all on about, because he jumps around in time a lot in his stories. And again, in these two short stories that we read, both have this disjointed, crazy chronology. At the moment that Carter is considering whether or not he's going to shoot the horseman, as is his duty, and he's got the horseman in his sights, we are treated to a flashback.
Yep, and it's I guess they're eating dinner or something along those lines, and basically Carter tells his dad, who is never named, but tells his dad that he wants to join a union. And his dad really tellingly tells him, "Well, you're a traitor to Virginia, and don't tell your mother."
It's a wonderfully dryly written sequence. The father just says, like, "I suppose you think this is your duty," and he says, "But Virginia will have to continue on without you." And your mother is not long for the world, the doctor says, so we better not upset her. But if we both survive to the end of the war, we shall speak on this further.
That's real parent guilt at work there.
I don't think that the dialogue at that point is actually, I don't remember if it's direct dialogue or paraphrase, but it does completely tell you almost everything you need to know about this father.
He's a very he's loyal to the South.
He's loyal to the South, but he's not insensitive to the fact that his son is being drawn in a different direction. He's disappointed, but his sense of honor.
It's kind of a kids these days type of thing, a bit. But I think the dad is insensitive because he pulls a whole guilt trip. Well, don't tell your mother because she might die, basically. Which I think is the ultimate tactic. Would be the ultimate tactic for guilting your kid. Well, you have a kid or two. You probably understand that.
Well, none of them have asked me to go join the Union Army yet, but I'll think about it, what my response is.
Yeah, you better get ready.
Carter Drews goes off. We have been told earlier that he came from rich stock, and this may be why he's fallen asleep on his job.
He's just a fancy rich boy.
Nonetheless, is able to rise in the ranks, partly because he know, as you mentioned, he knows the land so well, and that makes him extremely valuable to his regiment.
I guess he joined up just for this attack, pretty much, because they were nearby, and I guess they is this more opportunistic on the Union's part of like, hey, this guy knows the land and he likes us, so this is kind of a win-win.
What we're treated to here is a long discussion of sight lines. Carter can see the horseman, and he's considering whether the horseman has seen anything that compromises the Union's position, and he's imagining what view the horseman has, and then he looks down into the valley, and he can see that some Union officer has allowed his men to come out and water their horses in the open in the glade down there. We're kind of seeing the triangulation of these three vantage points, and everyone seems to have imperfect knowledge of what's going on. Carter is the only one who knows that the horseman is watching the Union soldiers, and the horseman can see the Union soldiers but cannot see Carter. And the Union soldiers, I suppose, are oblivious to everyone. Now we're getting the payoff of all this time setting up the battlefield. There was a wonderful line early on in here where Beer says, "No country is so wild and difficult, but men will make it a theater of war." And that line I've actually heard quoted before I realized it was from this story. That's the kind of beautiful writing that Bierce does, which is sort of aphoristic, very clean and cold and
And concise.
concise. He had a nickname which people called him Bitter Bierce because he had a reputation of being a nihilist. But I always see of him as like a very hard-nosed realist. The tension of the scene at this point is very strong. Now Carter is hesitating to shoot this soldier. Up to this point, it seems mostly out of the fact that he just has never actually shot someone before, that he feels wrong to shoot a man without warning, although he realizes that that's his duty.
I think because of flashback, he might sense it might be his father. But that's whatever. It's a short, it's like 4 pages long. It's not a spoiler. But I was reading it a second time. I got the feeling that he realized that could be his father, and that is also why he is afraid to fire.
Yeah, I think that the authorial plan is that Beerus knows that the minute that the horseman turns, the soldier knows it's his father. But he's playing this game with the reader, who hasn't read the first time through, presumably doesn't know that it's his father. Although he's dropped a lot of hints, he's dropped these hints that the father and the son are on different sides. But he's going to keep that knowledge from the reader. Of course, it's kind of funny because at the end, we'll talk about it when his commanding officer comes up and asks him what happens. He has no patience for Carter's hesitance to say anything himself. He kind of is a stand-in for the reader at that point. There's yet a third character now, an unnamed Union officer who is out scouting along the bottom of the cliff. And as Carter makes his decision and actually does shoot, but he shoots the horse, and the officer below the cliff stares up and he sees this horse descending, falling off the side of the cliff, but looking for all the world like it's just galloping through the air to him.
Like a Valkyrie.
This is the section from which the story gets its name, but it's kind of completely extraneous to the plot in a way. It's kind of just it's like this, the plot has revolved around the son and the father. Now we have this officer and his momentary vision of a horseman in the sky, and then he goes off trying to find the horseman. Once he hears it land, he can't find it. And he just kind of goes back and he tells his commanding officer, oh, I didn't find anything useful when I was out. And it's such an odd kind of thing.
I feel like that's a Beerus having fun, kind of like just messing with the reader. Like, well, the Carter doesn't get the titular line; it's some other guy. That's what it feels like to me.
No, I agree. I think that the part of what is happening here is every single person, aside from perhaps Carter, is operating with incomplete information. And the soldier from below doesn't know that this horse has just been shot. To his way of seeing things, there is this mysterious, mystical rider in the sky, almost like an apparition, and he can't explain it, and he never will be able to explain it because he will never have the full story. The horseman, has had his horse shot out from underneath him and probably is insensible to what has happened to him all the way down the cliff. And we're invited as readers to reflect on the fact that we have the vantage point that none of these characters have, and still it kind of adds up to not much of significance happens for the war. A lot of significance happens between Carter and the horsemen. Ultimately, everything goes on without them. There is an ending here where the commanding officer comes up to Carter, asks him if he did in fact shoot because he heard the gun go off, and Carter says, "Well, I shot a horse," and the commanding officer again just very dryly says, like, "Don't make a mystery of it."
And he says, "It's my father." He says, "Good God." And that's how it ends.
It reminded me so much of a Tales from the Crypt ending, with the Good Lord ending of a Tales from the Crypt. It's funny because I feel like that's supposed to, in some ways, be the payoff of the story. Is that twist at the end that, oh my God, he shot his father. In the end, I found that to be one of the most uninteresting parts of the story, whereas I was completely drawn in by the whole description of the scenery and the logistics of what was going on and getting inside Carter's head there. So at the end, the poignancy that he had to kill his own father didn't amount to much to me. Maybe that means that I'm a callous and hurt hateful person, I
I
guess.
like the very abrupt kind of like dryly funniness of the end. Just end with someone saying, "Good God," after a son just killed his father, and it's just like this very, this like the, to me is a very weird, funny way to end the story.
Well, I guess we're both
Yeah.
horrible people. Let's move to Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is one of the most anthologized stories in American literature. And
I was trying to look up when Occurrence became like a high school standard, but I couldn't find anything. It just feels like this must have been like a high school standard, like when they started doing assigned reading in high schools.
I don't think we're going to be spoiling anything for anyone. I think everyone knows what happens in an Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, but it fits completely into that tradition that I touched on earlier when I did the episode about the monkey's paw and the lady with the tiger and the most dangerous game, in that it's a story with a twist ending, and those were extremely popular for high school literature. I think, at the time when I was talking about that with John Syracuse, he said he thinks it was to get students to pay attention.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Well, especially for someone like for me in high school, that would've been the only way to get me. I think that's the reason I like these stories in high school, because they weren't like boring and, well, at the time, stupid and boring. It was like, oh, wait, that's a weird ending, and it's so like, so for like a terrible student like me, it was just like a good thing to go like, hey, pay attention.
I do remember reading this in class, and I do remember that when we get to the end, there were a lot of people, kids, who were just very confused by the ending, and then there were other kids who said, "Oh, don't you understand what's happening here?" and lording it over the other kids. The one thing I will say about the twist ending we'll get to is I think it's a mistake to put too much importance on it. I think that it certainly is a punctuation mark at the end of a story, but I think that if you read it through carefully, there's a lot that Bierce is doing with time and perception and different speeds of perception that is set up from the very beginning. And I think that that's really important. And I think that the ending is not so important. We'll talk about the ending because some people find it a very cruel and heartless ending, and Bierce has been accused of just being mean to his characters, but we'll talk about
The character in this one is Payne Farquhar. He's a mildly successful plantation owner. I guess a small farm, a mart-sized farm. And he's loyal to Confederacy. And he comes from a long line of, like, a good bloodline from northern Alabama. And I'm not sure how to summarize it without just it being too quick.
It opens with Peyton Farquhar about to be hung.
Yeah, well, hanged.
Hanged, sorry, you're right. Hanged. About to be hanged off of the railroad bridge at over Owl Creek. And there's again, a lot of discussion about the logistics of what's going on here. It's a railroad bridge. The ties have blank spaces between them. And Peyton is being suspended between two railroad ties on a plank.
And there are two guards at each end.
Logistically, what's happening is a Union soldier is counterbalancing the plank, but the minute he steps free, Peyton will fall between the railroad ties and be hanged. And it's a lot of discussion of what the railroad tracks are like and what the woods are like and how far below Owl Creek is. It's about what, 20 feet or 20 yards, I can't remember. Another brilliant line by Bierce comes here where he says, "Death is a dignitary who, when he comes announced, is to be received with formal manifestations of respect, even by those most familiar with him. In the code of military etiquette, silence and fixity are forms of deference.
I was about to say that. That was one of the ones I, one of the really good lines I wanted to use. I mean, like, for like someone to read.
It's a lovely description of how horrible this is, and yet how the military conduct provides it with a kind of a circumscribed ritual, and that's supposed to be dignified, that's supposed to be to be proper, but it's causing enormous distress for Peyton, because he has to sit there and endure this. Early on, he hears this loud metallic clanging getting louder and louder, and he thinks at first it's some sort of a metal machinery or something clanking, or perhaps a gun going off.
But then you learn it's his watch, and that's a little foreshadowing for a little bit later. I like that he's described. It's like his features were good: a straight nose, firm mouth, broad forehead, from which his long dark hair was combed straight back, falling behind his ears to the collar of his well-fitting frock coat.
When Bierce describes him, Bierce says that the code, he talks about the code of military conduct allowing for it says the liberal military code makes provisions for hanging many kinds of persons, and gentlemen are not excluded. So Peyton may be kind of bourgeois, but he's going to get hanged anyway.
Oh, well, going back to the one about death as a dignitary, that kind of goes against the reason that he's there in the first place.
Well, we do get that reason just as the sergeant steps aside and Peyton is about to fall through.
And at that part, he uses the term unsteadfast footing, which is a Shakespeare reference, apparently.
At that moment, we get another flashback that is that, you know, recalls very much the same device he used in A Horseman in the Sky. We start in media res. We're brought to a moment of tension, of something explosive about to happen, and then we're pulled back and given the backstory. And in this case, Peyton was not an actual soldier in the war.
But you learn he's an original secessionist. He would basically would do anything for the Confederacy to help it. And they specifically talk about the fall of Corinth. I don't know much about Civil War history, but I'm assuming that was a major battle.
The fall of Corinth. Why don't we just look it up in Google? So the siege of Corinth was in 62 in Corinth, Mississippi. And it was an attack on the basically the rail system for the Confederacy. That makes sense to be mentioned in the context of this story. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Do you know if Bierce, where he fought exactly? Did he fight like in the Deep South?
Yeah, Bierce. Again, let's look up and let's go to Wikipedia. He was in a West Virginia campaign, and he fought at Rich Mountain, and he fought the Battle of Shiloh, and then he got his big wound at the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain.
Oh, okay.
So he was out of the war in 64. But he that was a long time to be in the war, actually. I mean, not many people lasted that long. So he was there from about the beginning to just a little bit under a year from the end.
So we were at the flashback part, and sort of he is with his wife on their porch, And then there's someone in a gray coat approaches him and tells him that the Yanks are repairing the railroads, and the soldier tells him that, hey, it'd be easier for a civilian to burn down and get in the way of the Union than a soldier. And so, of course, Peyton is like, well, yeah, I'll do that. And we get to, it's 30 miles away, and so he immediately starts walking there, and then you learn that basically it was a setup to catch him, or to hang someone, I guess.
So now we know that he was entrapped into coming to try to destroy the bridge. Reading it through again this time, I kind of felt this seems like a big fishing expedition for the Union to be going on, just to go house to
Yeah.
house and tell people that there's a bridge up here that could be sabotaged. I'll forgive Beerus this, but I find that actually is the part of the story that I have a hard time believing.
It seems kind of pointless to just find an excuse to hang someone, unless he's trying to point out like the brutality of war, and it brings out the worst in people, which I guess is basically that.
It's also a good example of a plan that was doomed before it started. Poor Peyton does not have he doesn't have a lot of agency in this story. He kind of, the minute he tries to take agency for himself, he basically gets squashed by the Union forces, and maybe by implication by the universe. It would have been better for him to just have stayed at home on his plantation. But anyway, he to move back to Peyton, out of the flashback and back into the hanging, we have this description of him going down into the water, or above the water, and it's it the hanging fails to break his neck, which is famously what you don't want to have happen to you, because then you're going to suffocate while you hang there. And a really brutal bit of writing here by Beers.
As Peyton Farquhar fell straight downward through the bridge, he lost consciousness and was as one already dead. From this state, he was awakened, ages later, it seemed to him, by the pain of a sharp pressure upon his throat, followed by a sense of suffocation. Keen, poignant agony seemed to shoot from his neck downward through every fiber of his body and limbs. These pains appeared to flash along well-defined lines of ramification and to beat with an inconceivably rapid periodicity. They seemed like streams of pulsating fire, heating him to an intolerable temperature. As to his head, he was conscious of nothing but a feeling of fullness, of congestion. These senses were unaccompanied by thought. The intellectual part of his nature was already effaced. He had the power only to feel, and feeling was torment.
There's a line here that I thought was quite interesting, where he says, what is it? The intellectual part of his nature was already effaced. He had power only to feel, and feeling was torment. And I think there was an interesting point earlier where he talked about how that it took a while to write these thoughts down that he was having, but the time was working differently for him. That although it takes a long time to write this, these things just emerged in his head as quickly as they could. And I think again, this is a clue by Beerus about the kind of weirdness that time is playing in this moment for Peyton, where everything is subjective. Even before the actual hanging, time slows down. There's a part where he looks at the creek and talks about how slow it's going and how he
He
can't.
sees a piece of driftwood freely, going, basically a driftwood is what he wants to be, more or less.
after hitting the end of the rope and struggling for a minute, he splashes through to the water, realizes that the rope is broken, and we get this extremely slow description of what goes through his head about how he tries to free himself from his bonds, how he tries to free himself from the rope, how when he takes the rope off, it causes more pain than it was when it was on.
And basically, he's in a worse situation because it's more likely he's going to drown. And so it's, instead of it being his first steps of freedom being glorious, it's just horrific.
It's bad enough to be hanged, but it's worse to be to drown. And then when it seems like he's getting free from that, he realizes he's going to get shot by the soldiers, and he dives as deeply as he can into the water. There are bullets whizzing through the water around him. He gets caught in a current, though, and tossed downstream. This, what we're describing here, while it's not a ton of plot action, takes up about 4 or 5 pages of the story, this kind of extremely slow, very methodical description of his state of mind and of what's happening. And it's always told from that perspective, because when he hits the water, we don't know what's happened other than he talks about the coldness of the water and the way that the light changes. And then he understands that the rope is broken. And similarly, once the current catches him, we're told from the first person perspective of him being tossed around. But only later do we understand how far down the river he's gone.
Yeah, and when they start shooting at him, he has the capacity to still think properly, because he says, "To be hanged and drowned," he thought, "that is not so bad, but I do not wish to be shot. No, I will not be shot. That is not fair."
The issue of fairness is heavy in his mind, because, as we've said, he's being hanged for something he didn't do.
Yeah, it was just a setup to, by these very cruel soldiers, to hang someone.
He does make it by the current, away from the bridge, down to the side of the river where he's able to pull himself out. There's this description that here, to me, seems the most Lovecraftian, where he's talking about traveling by night and seeing constellations that aren't real constellations, and hearing voices in the trees. And it seems as though the universe is strange and hostile and utterly alien. And he keeps touching his throat at this point, and it's still in pain. It's still throbbing, which again is foreshadowing. But it's this one single paragraph here of the strange constellations, where Bierce allows himself to kind of go over the line of straight realism into this kind of inner world of delirium in Peyton's head, that really, I think, speaks to future authors. Bierce is seen sometimes as a forerunner of stream of consciousness writing, although I don't think you'd ever confuse Bierce with Faulkner or with Proust, but you can see where.
Yeah, this feels very. It feels very, like, kind of writing a diary-esque, but also you can tell it's very planned out, and he knew exactly what he's going to do.
Peyton makes it through the night, and he comes to the gate of his own home. It switches over to present tense here. We're kind of used to these tricks in the 20th century, but I think that would be extremely surprising to a 19th century reader who's going along happily in past tense to suddenly have this present tense. He stands at the gate of his own home. All is as he left it, and all bright and beautiful in the morning sunshine. And he comes and he sees his wife. And do you want to do the honors here? tell the shock ending.
Well, It turns out that was all in his head, and he was hanged.
Right. Very abruptly, we get this ending of a particularly nasty one, insofar as we get to see what's going on in his head at the very last moment, with this flash of light and then cold darkness, and there is no nod to any kind of afterlife or any kind of redemption at the end of his life.
Well, Beerus himself was apparently a self-described agnostic.
It's this ending, this twist ending, that people think of most readily when they think of the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. But I think, as I said, reading it through again this time, I was struck by how tricky and malleable time is throughout the entire story. And I, again, before the hanging, as well as afterwards, and I thought at the end, what part of what's happening here with this wish fulfillment in the last minutes of this guy's life is, it's not simply Peyton's wish fulfillment, it's the wish fulfillment for the reader. The reader wants there to be a happy ending. The reader wants there to be some sort of redemption for the character. And Bierce is kind of playing a bit of a scold here and saying, like, yeah, but that's not the way the world works. That would be a terribly contrived thing to do. And so he comes up with perhaps the most contrived ending you can possibly come up with. Not only does the rope break, but he's able to escape the soldiers, and he comes to his home where his wife embraces him. It's a fantasy.
It's a little too convenient. The thing I really noticed this time was when he first when a fantasy first starts to happen, it doesn't really happen until about a paragraph in or so. Because if you really like read the paragraph, if you read like the start of section 3, there's no really it doesn't really technically, he's still falling and being hanged for most of the first part, and so found interesting that it's not immediately a fantasy. It starts out as reality, but then it shifts.
Bierce wants us to go back and look and you know, it's sort of like with a lot of thrillers where there's some sort of a twist. You want to go back and see whether the author has been fair with you, whether the author said anything that couldn't that didn't actually support the ending. And Bierce, you know, it's a simple twist. It's not a long story. It's not, you know, a crazy series of improbable coincidences, like say reading Gone Girl or something like that. You know, so you feel like it's okay at the end. Now, I think when I was younger, when I read this, I really fell heavily on the side of people who feel that Bierce is just being cruel for no good reason. I felt like this was a just a bad an ugly story that was ugly to its characters and kind of ugly by extension to the readership. But this time I don't feel that way. I feel like I actually feel oddly like Bierce has a strange sympathy for Peyton, and the fantasy is almost it's almost as if the fantasy is the only grace that Peyton has allowed in a world, if you believe that the world is uncaring and against you. It's kind of the Brazil ending, you know, that you escape. And maybe it's fake, maybe it's a lie. You know, there are stories like this. That's the way that this Kiss of the Spider Woman ends too, is with kind of like retreating into a lie, or Pan's Labyrinth or something like that. There's kind of a long tradition of this idea that the only escape for from an ugly world is into fiction.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Am I bringing us all down here?
I don't know. I need a second to gather my thoughts after that. And I find I still kind of feel that it's just kind of cruel for sake of being cruel. And I feel like, a little bit of that, and also, I think is this, Pierce, I keep saying Pierce, Beers is this basically, showing, I think part of it is Beers showing that war can bring out the worst in people. And I think, this is probably something he saw happen, or something along the lines of this people that's for no reason trying to look for an excuse just to, you know, execute someone.
Well, you wanted to read the story. Did they live up to your hopes?
I like them a lot more now. Yeah, the writing's just very beautiful and concise and to the point, and I don't know, it's just, I've been reading his other stories now because I bought the whole collection on Kindle, and I just really just love everything about his writing. It really appeals to me.
I am very interested after reading these two stories to read some of his other stuff. I'd be really fascinated to find some of his journalism if I could. I don't know if that was collected. Probably it's been collected in scholarly editions, but
The thing on the Kindle book I got was the complete works, and it has journalism, his journalism stuff, his article, his poetry, short stories, and like the three novellas he wrote.
Wow. Well, you'll be busy for a while then. Did make me really also want to read a good biography of Bierce, because he really does seem like a fascinating guy. He seems like he seems to me to be of a strong kindred spirit to someone like Mark Twain, and I think that there was something about having lived through such a horrible time and then made it into the Gilded Age, which was also a horrible time, but in a different way, that I think brought out some of our sharpest and most incisive writing. I think that certainly Twain comes from this period. Edith Wharton comes from this period. I think that it's just really, really interesting stuff. And
I was looking up his, like, who else was, like, who his contemporaries were, to see if anyone else was as staunchly anti-war. And it seems like Bierce's main thing was, like, to de-glorify everything about the Civil War. One of his things. And I do like that aspect of this, making a point of, war is a terrible thing, and I'm going to, in a very dry way, show it to you.
Yeah, I think that probably was a pretty hard sell too at that time, because they people were so close to it at that point that nobody wanted to, you know how it is with a war, nobody wants to go back and say maybe it wasn't worth it, because the feeling is that would somehow diminish the sacrifice that the veterans had made.
I have a feeling he probably got some angry letters at some point in his career.
It's a funny story, I guess, to teach to high school students.
Well, I was a typical student who hated assigned reading, and it worked on me. Usually I don't like twist endings, but with Bierce, it totally works. Like, for me, twist endings work maybe 1 out of 10 times, because I think they... most of the time they're done poorly, or it's just kind of like a twist for sake of a twist. But Bierce really understands how to utilize it correctly.
Thanks to co-host Spencer Seams. Look for his podcast, Tune In Tonight.
Thanks for the reading by Zach Powers. His podcast is called Stage of Fools. And thanks as always for the theme music from Malcolm Nygaard, who can be found at epochgraffiti.com. You can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join in the discussion on the Facebook page for Sophomore Lit. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. Next time, join us as we take on Crime and Punishment. And remember, everything will be on the final.